This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Residents in a number of Florida counties are now eligible for federal disaster assistance from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The emergency declaration is for counties across South Florida on both the Gulf and Atlantic coasts, as well as inland counties like Hendry and DeSoto. But what's involved in applying for the FEMA relief? Who exactly is eligible, and what should you expect before, during, and after you apply? Here to walk us through the process and answer your questions on getting FEMA relief for Hurricane Irma is Cherie Brown. She's the media specialist with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
What questions do you have for FEMA about getting help after Hurricane Irma? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Cherie, you have your hands full. This has been a big storm in Florida and the Virgin Islands. The agency itself is big. So you're mainly South Florida?
Yes.
Okay, so you're going to—
I'm covering Fort Myers and Naples area.
So you're going to be our person for the next foreseeable future.
Yes.
All right. So when we say federal disaster relief is available, what exactly does that mean for people?
Okay. So an emergency declaration was declared, but on September the 10th, the president declared Florida— a number of counties. To date, there are 46 counties that has been designated for the September 4th event that occurred from Hurricane Irma. So now what that means is individuals that suffered damage to their primary residence from the September 4th incident are now may now register with FEMA for assistance by going to disasterassistance.gov. There are a number of ways that they can apply for assistance. If they don't have internet, they can actually use their mobile app. They can use FEMA mobile app and apply online there.
Yeah, we've noticed a lot of people still have their cell phones, even though they may not have internet access or they may not have electricity. There are charging stations, so people are able to stay connected, it seems like. So the app seems like probably the way to go for a lot of people that still don't have electricity.
Yes, that's the best way. We do have a helpline number. However, if you do have internet access, please go to disasterassistance.gov. That's disasterassistance.gov, and you can register there. You may also call our helpline number, which is 1-800-621-3362. And that helpline is open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time.
So we have links to all that on WGCUnews.org, too, in case somebody missed it and didn't get that written down. So, and we'll also repeat it a little bit later in the show. But I wanted to ask, one of the questions that comes to mind when I think about federal disaster assistance, what if I already have insurance? Does this fill in the blanks that insurance doesn't do? Or how does insurance play when it comes to disaster assistance for people?
Okay. So your first primary line of recovery would be to call your insurance company if you have insurance. If you do not have insurance, you may apply for FEMA for assistance. It doesn't matter if you have insurance or not. Calling your insurance company is the first line of defense. Secondly, once you've called the insurance company, FEMA does not duplicate benefits. However, by registering with FEMA and if you become eligible to receive assistance, FEMA does not, by law, we cannot duplicate insurance benefits, but you may be eligible for items that your insurance may not cover.
Yeah, some people may have hurricane insurance, but they may not have flood insurance, for example.
Yes.
So that's what that's kind of picking up what's left there is what FEMA does.
Well, we have also where our assistance in the form of a grant is two types of assistance. First, we have assistance for temporary housing. So if you've been displaced from your home, you may be eligible for temporary housing assistance. And then also we have assistance for emergency repairs and replacements of items to help you rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
So the assistance does not make you whole again, but it's to get you on the road to recovery.
Mm-hmm. So first thing you do, you call your insurance agency if you have insurance, see what your insurance is going to cover. And then when you find out what insurance is not going to cover, is that when you start your contact with FEMA? Or should someone start contact with FEMA simultaneously?
We're encouraging you, if you were impacted by this storm, to register with FEMA, whether you have insurance or not.
Okay, so get your information in there.
Yes.
Is it kind of a first-come, first-serve thing? Or do you handle everybody?
Well, we handle everybody. We're trying to get to everyone as quickly as possible. But we're encouraging anyone that was impacted to register online. Once you register, once you call or register online, you'll need to have, of course, your personal contact information, your Social Security number, your primary residence, the address of your primary residence, the address of that residence, any description of the damage that occurred in the home. Take photos and pictures. Keep that and keep your receipts and document all of your
expenditures.
Yes.
Yeah, because a lot of people run out there and they start to get things dried out because they don't want the mold to get in, you know?
Well, exactly. You want to make sure you start cleaning up. And you don't have to wait for FEMA assistance before you start cleaning up. So as I mentioned before, take photographs of everything, document, keep your receipts, and then go ahead and with the Red Cross and Salvation Army and a lot of nonprofit organizations are here to help as well. So you can seek assistance from them. They'll often have cleaning supplies to help you clean up. Once you start cleaning and you get your registration with FEMA, you will receive a registration number. That's the number that you will follow, that will follow you throughout your application process. If you need to call back, you refer to that registration number. Once you get your registration number, after a few days, you'll get a call from one of our inspectors that will set up an appointment to come out to assess the damage. We'll need to have an adult at the home to show all of the damages. And the inspector is not going to make a determination at that point. They're just coming in to assess the damage.
So you call up. You give all your information that you have. Let's bullet point those one more time so people are prepared.
Okay.
The things that you need to have when you call in, you need to have your Social Security number. Only one of those per household. You don't have to have everybody's Social Security number.
Correct, because only one primary homeowner is going to apply for assistance. Everyone in the household does not have to apply.
Okay. And then you have to have the address of the damaged home.
Correct.
And a description of what that damage is.
Yes, and it has to be your primary residence.
Okay, so that could be a thing for people here because there are a lot of people that have a secondary residence down here. So if it's a snowbird, for example, that normally lives in Minnesota and has a condo down here, the FEMA may not be the thing for them.
If it is referred as if they can claim it as their primary residence, they may apply for assistance.
Okay. Well, a lot of people do claim this as their primary residence anyway because of the lack of a state income tax in Florida. So people like to have that. So let's stick with the information we have to have. You have to have information about what your insurance coverage is. When you're a homeowner, do you need to say the name and your policy number? The name of the whoever is insuring
you
your
just
home?
Have to verify your insurance. You provide that paperwork.
Okay, gotcha.
So the helpline assistance will tell them specifically about that.
All those.
So they just have to have their insurance information, who the insurance is with, the amount of coverage. And that is because FEMA, by law, cannot duplicate insurance benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And then a telephone number and a mailing address, and then a bank account and routing numbers for direct deposit funds.
Yes, that's if you select to have your funds, if you're eligible to go directly to your bank account, or you may have a check mailed to you. Some people, if they have to move out of their homes, they won't be there to receive a check, so it's better for them to do the direct deposit.
But yeah, so it's a little frightening to know that you're going to have a big check coming to your house and you're not going to be there. Nobody wants that to happen. So I wanted to ask also, are there any people that are just not eligible? I mean, what if somebody has a really big house and it's worth a ton of money and they have a bunch of money in the bank? Are they eligible to apply for these kind of FEMA benefits?
Well, eligibility is not based on income, race, or origin, national origin. It's based on the criteria of if you receive damage to your home and insurance may not have covered some of those items, then you may be eligible for items that the insurance company will not pay out on.
All right. And then I wanted to ask also about renters. What about people that are renting places? Does it cover property inside of a rental unit?
Yes. Renters are able to register for items that they lost to their personal property. So when you fill out the application with FEMA, there's a portion that will ask you about the Small Business Administration. You must fill out that Small Business Administration packet in order to be referred to FEMA. So fill that out. That is the Small Business Administration offer loans. FEMA offer grants. FEMA funding can't make you whole, but SBA can. However, you do not have to accept the SBA loan. That is just part of the process to get you to FEMA assistance, mm-hmm. for other needs assistance, for if you lost your vehicle or other personal property. If there were a loss of life, it helps to cover for burial expenses, any medical expenses or medications that you may have lost as well.
What's the turnaround time on this? I know everything just hit, but you apply. And when do people expect to see an inspector knocking on the door to check out the property?
Well, this was a massive storm. Ideally, usually after you register, it can take anywhere from 5 to 7 days. This was a huge event. We're working as quickly as we possibly can. I do know that we've had over 100,000 registrations. And funds have been approved. Close to $16 million has been approved. So we're working expeditiously to get to everyone as quickly as we possibly can. We do ask that you be patient with us as we're trying to get through this big storm. This process, this storm hit multiple states as well as the Caribbean. So we're working as fast as we possibly can to make sure. But please follow up if you happen to move, change your location. We want to make sure that we have all of your contact information because that may slow the process a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So just keep your information updated once you register.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea, especially if you have something coming. You know, you want to make sure that you get that in the right bank account too. So when you do the house inspection, you actually physically, FEMA actually goes to every house that files a claim? Like physically walks into every home? And
okay. Once you register with FEMA, an inspector is going to come out and schedule an appointment to come out, yes, to assess the damage of that property.
Have there been any scams or people posing as if they are FEMA to go check on things?
We do ask that you be alert and be aware of fraudulent activity going on. When our inspectors come out, they're going to have your registration number, so that's that they'll already have.
Somebody comes to your door and they don't have your registration number, they're probably not
FEMA. Probably not FEMA. And they do have a FEMA, have an ID badge, mm-hmm. to identify who they are. If you feel concerned about who that person is, then I would refer you to your local authorities. Call law enforcement right away.
Yeah. So you've been on the ground today in Fort Myers. You got here just last week, I think, or earlier this week?
Well, we've had teams on the ground from the very beginning, even before everything took place.
Yeah. You get the before and after shot. What is your sense of this storm and what's been left? I mean, you know, you've been with FEMA for a while, but you've been going out in the field now for a few years. What do you feel when you go out there and see all this?
Well, this is a big storm. You know, it was massive. I happened to see some of the damage here on the campus as I was coming in. So, yeah, it was a big storm.
Is there anything else that we need to alert our listeners about when it comes to FEMA that we didn't cover? I know we went over all the information that you need to have when you do call FEMA or when you do register. Let's give out these web addresses and phone numbers one more time. We've got www.disasterassistance.gov, and the phone number is 800-621-FEMA, which is 3362. So 800-621-3362. And we're going to have all of that on WGCUnews.org in case anybody missed those phone numbers and didn't have a pencil at the ready when we were giving those out. So I want to thank you for helping us with these first steps of walking through dealing with FEMA and seeing what's available out there and who's eligible and who isn't. I really appreciate you coming in and talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Sharia Brown with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, thank you so much for being here. I really do appreciate it. And we will have all of that information also available at WGCUnews.org. Thank you. Counties in southwest Florida are slowly seeing signs of recovery after Hurricane Irma. Stores are opening up. Power is being restored for some, and curfews and boil water notices are being lifted. But that's not the case in Collier County, one of the coastal areas hardest hit by Irma, where boil water notices remain in place. A mandatory curfew remains in place for all of Collier County between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. And an ongoing lack of power is delaying store openings, backing up sewage systems, and otherwise delaying the long-sought return to normalcy for many. Here to give an update on these and other issues that the Collier County government, utilities, and local emergency operations officials are sorting through nearly a week after Irma hit our coast is Margie Hapke, a spokesperson for Collier Public Utilities. Thanks for joining Gulf Coast Live, Margie.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So Collier County sent out requests for residents to cut back on their water use due to ongoing sewage concerns in the county. What's going on? I've heard reports from people saying that they're smelling sewage in their neighborhoods.
One of the problems that we have in this area is because the topography is so flat, we can't rely on gravity sewer systems the way they do in the rest of the country. In Collier County, we have more than 800 pump stations located throughout the collection system. The pump station, they take the sewage that comes through the neighborhood, they pump it to the next neighborhood, they pump it to the next neighborhood until it gets to the treatment plant. Right now, the issue that we've got is that a significant number of these pump stations are without electrical power, so the pumps aren't functioning. When the pumps don't function, the wastewater collects in the pipe and eventually will back up. It'll back up through the manholes in the streets, or unfortunately it will back up into people's homes and businesses. So we are going out with pumper trucks. We're putting generators on as many of these lift stations, these pump stations, as we can to alleviate that issue. One of the reasons we're asking people to cut back on their water usage is if the pump station in your neighborhood isn't functioning because it doesn't have power and you're putting a lot of water down into the system, it's just causing an overload on the system and it's going to make it back up.
So you're asking people to try to avoid flushing the toilet a bunch of times and try to avoid doing laundry and taking long showers, things like that?
The biggest thing is don't do laundry, don't run your dishwasher. You know, minimize showers if you can, minimize flushing if you can. The old saying, if it's yellow, leave it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down.
Yeah.
That type of thing. And, you know, marine showers where you just get wet, turn the water off, soap up, turn the water on to rinse. You know, everything like that will help. The less water that we can put into the system right now, the better off we're going to be.
Do you have a way of tracking hot spots, so to speak, places that are having backups, or are you asking people to call in and report when they're noticing things happening in their street that smell a little off?
People are calling in to report the sewage backups, which is great. That's what we need them to do. We want them to call. If you're within Collier County, you can dial 311 to report those issues. We do have crews out there 24/7 who are going. We have telemetry systems on the pump stations where we can see them when, you know, where those antennas have not been damaged. So we have visual on the pump stations, but some of those stations have been damaged. The antennas aren't functioning, so we don't have visuals on all of them. But we do have crews going 24/7 with pump trucks and generators to try to keep, you know, those stations going. What we're going to start doing today is that in certain areas across the county, we're going to do, if we need to, we'll do rolling temporary water service interruptions. So if we go into a neighborhood where we've got, you know, a pump station that needs to be repaired, we either have to pull the pump or we've got to put a generator or something on it to do a temporary permanent fix for that station, we may turn the water off in that neighborhood while we work on the pump station. So I want people to know that if you have water and then it goes off, it may be because we've turned it off because we're in your neighborhood working on your pump station. But as soon as we get the work completed, we'll turn the water back on. So it could be, water could be off for 30 minutes, maybe an hour, but it will come back on.
After that service interruption, do people need to do the boil? I know there's already a boil order right now, but if, you know, in the next day or so that anything's lifted, you do need to do a boil order after your service interruption?
No. The boil water notice is going to stand until further notice. It's just because we're having this issue with the wastewater collection system, mm-hmm, is the reason for the boil water notice. And that's going to stand until we get the wastewater collection system back functioning normal.
Okay. And so how many pump stations how many do you have that are kind of knocked off right now that aren't working?
There are more than 800 in the system. At one point, we had 60% or so that were off. We're recovering a lot of them, but there's still a real significant number that are out there that are not functioning correctly.
What knocked them out? Was it the lack of electricity?
It's the lack of electricity,
okay.
Yes. One of the other issues that we had was because of the sheet flow and the localized flooding that the hurricane caused, some of the the pump stations were actually underwater. So that was another issue.
So when they go underwater, does that damage them? Then those are the ones that would probably need to be replaced?
That causes the pumps to malfunction when they're underwater, sure.
All right. All right.
One thing about the temporary water service interruptions, we're trying to limit those to between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. so that people, they get up in the morning, they'll still have water service to shower, get ready for work, do whatever they need to do, and then when they come home in the afternoon, they'll have water service through the evening.
Yeah.
So we're trying to do these temporary outages between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m.
I don't know, it's kind of hard to give a prognosis on things, but what kind of time frame are you looking at to try to get things back to normal? I know you're working on it around the clock, but does it look like it's possible things will be back to normal in a week or a couple days?
I really hate to say. I just don't know. We're working 24/7. FPNL is working 24/7 with us into these critical areas to try to get power restored to these pump stations. I would hope it would be sooner than later, but I'm not in a position to say, how many days or weeks it'll be.
Yeah, the instant you say that it's going to be this day, it might go one day longer and everybody's mad. I understand what you're saying about that because nobody really wants their neighborhood to smell like that. So say you have an issue in your home and things are getting backed up. Is there any advice that you're giving to homeowners when they've noticed that things are backing up? Obviously, don't try to flush the toilet anymore. What else can people do?
Yeah. Obviously, just stop using as much water as absolutely possible. One thing, just stop using water until it recedes. Eventually it will recede. And then, just stay out of the area. If it backs up like into your tub drain or into your shower drain, you're just going to need to let it set until the system recovers and it recedes. And then you're going to need to disinfect the area. A quick solution of 1/4 cup of household bleach per gallon of water is a good disinfectant solution that they can use.
Mm-hmm. Can people use maybe bottled water to do things like toothbrushing and things? Is that going to overload the system?
Well, if you use bottled water, if you don't have power and you can't boil your water, yes, obviously using bottled water is a good option. And that keeps it from, just minimize what you put down the drain.
All right.
If you're going to use a bucket of water to kind of rinse your dishes, instead of dumping that water down the drain, go water a plant, water a house plant or something.
Exactly, yeah. But Calusa Waterkeepers on Twitter sent the following advice saying, no flushing of wipes, diapers, or other hygiene products, and also don't pour grease down the drain. Are those items also impactful?
Absolutely. You never want to pour grease down a drain because the grease collects in the pipes and then will eventually cause the pipe to clog up. So, and wipes, diapers, never, never. The toilet is not a trash can.
Yeah. And I want to shift the focus now. We kind of talked about the sewage system, but I know that we're working to get the drinking water situation taken care of. But Collier County is seeing some ongoing food relief efforts with distribution of meals, water, things like that. Can you give us an update on what's happening as far as distributing meals to people that can't cook because they don't have power?
We do have distribution points where they are issuing MREs, meals ready to eat. I think there are 5 distribution points. I know there's one in Immokalee, Everglades City, Goodland. I'm not sure where the other locations are. That's available on our website mm-hmm. at callyourgov.net.
Okay. And people can access that with their smartphones. And I want to turn another thing that's on people's minds is the trees and bushes and other debris in their yard, not to mention the piles of garbage and other waste that may have piled up. What's happening so far with the collections of waste and yard waste?
Yeah, let's start with trash. Trash collection in Collier County, that would be the unincorporated areas of Collier County, including the city of Marco and Everglades City. That resumed today. So we're back on normal collection schedule as of today. So if your collection day is tomorrow, your trash will be picked up tomorrow, and then, you know, then we're back on normal schedule. So it's trash and recycling only. Part of the problem that we're going to have is that people have run out of place to put their trash. They're mixing it with the recyclables. We're seeing that the recycling carts are contaminated with yard waste and with garbage. So right now we're just picking everything up as trash until we get everything off the street, and then we get back to normal.
Mm-hmm. And then yard waste, the yard waste is extensive.
Yes, the amount of storm debris is extensive. The county has a contract with ASHBRIT, which is a nationally recognized debris collection and monitoring contractor. They are here in Collier County. They have been working since immediately after the storm to do the first push to get all of the debris off of the main roads, off of the secondary primary roads. They are finishing that up. As that finishes up, then they will start going into the residential neighborhoods to collect the debris. So what people need to do is all of the storm-related debris, your downed trees, downed bushes, that sort of stuff, needs to be taken to the right-of-way in front of your house. That's basically between the street and the sidewalk, or the utility easement or the ditch in front of your property. Just pile it up loosely. Don't bag anything. No plastic bags, no paper bags. Just leave everything loose. Be very careful of where you put your piles. Don't put it in front of a higher fire hydrant. Don't block access to your mailbox. Don't put it up against a utility pole, because they do use claw trucks when they come in to pick that material up.
Oh, yeah.
But you don't want to put it anywhere where the claw truck might damage, you know, your mailbox or a fire hydrant or you know, anything else.
What we don't need is a fire hydrant getting knocked over by a claw truck. So, yeah, definitely keep those clear with that yard waste. I mean, there's a lot of it, but definitely a good idea to remind people to keep that stuff away from the fire hydrants especially, and then also your mailbox so those don't get knocked over.
And the utility poles, because obviously, you know,
yeah.
P&L's going out there working hard to put the poles back up. We don't want a claw truck to knock it down.
Yeah, that would be
a pile of yard debris.
That would not be a fun phone call to make.
No.
and then are there any dumpsters around for people that just can't take it if their trash is just stinking it up? Do you have any place for people to take stuff that they want to get rid of?
We don't at this point, no.
Okay. All right.
But commercial service has resumed, and now as of 7 o'clock this morning, residential service has resumed, and we are out there hitting it hard.
We've
got 60 trucks on the road, and they're going to take, if you have like little small stuff, like a little table or a chair or something that got damaged, if you put it out by your trash carts, if the guys can pick it up and throw it in the rear loader, they will. Our goal is get everything off the street.
And we're still having the curfew in Collier County, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Do you have any idea, any timeline on that?
I don't. That's the Collier County Sheriff's Department's call to make.
Oh, that's a law enforcement thing. All right.
Yeah, it is a law enforcement thing, but it is for everyone's safety. It's dark out there. We've got a lot of debris on the streets. It's hard to see.
Yeah.
If you don't need to be out, just don't be out.
Are there any other hazards or concerns in Collier that you want our listeners to be aware of?
Traffic intersections. If you come up to a signalized intersection and the signals aren't working, please, please, please treat it as a four-way stop.
Oh, I know.
Don't just go blow through it. Be courteous. Treat it as a four-way stop. One of the good news items that I picked up from the briefing in the EOC this morning is that in Collier County, 36% of the signalized intersections are back in service, including all of the primary intersections, and they are going great guns, going through, trying to bring all those traffic signals back up. But
it's quite a rebuilding effort that's going on, but just having individuals aware that those dark traffic signals, if there's nothing there, those are four-way stops. Now, if you have a flashing yellow or flashing red, that's you follow those as normal.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
But especially as it gets dark, you know, toward the dusk hours, you know, where if you're not going to, the traffic light isn't working.
You don't see anything.
Absolutely, it's got to be treated as a four-way stop. We don't want people playing bumper cars out there.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Well, thank you so much for the update. I really appreciate it. Speaking from Collier County, Margie Hapke, a spokesperson for the Collier Public Utilities, I really appreciate you taking the time to sort through a lot of things that a lot of people are concerned about.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much for letting us get the information out.
All right. Coming up, we'll talk with local chefs about how to cook when pantries are dwindling and power is still out. We'll hear what's okay to keep and what needs to be tossed after a power outage. And we'll have updates on school closings and the status of Lake Okeechobee. All that's next on Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. About this time last week, the worry about Hurricane Irma shifted from the east coast of the state to the center of Florida, where the country's largest freshwater lake sits with its aging dike surrounded by vulnerable communities. Lake Okeechobee is a source of concern every rainy season when water levels rise and put pressure on that Herbert Hoover dike. And as the storm shifted more westward, it became somewhat of a relief for that potential disaster. But Irma's northward track dumped rain to the north, which is finding its way south. And once again, the lake is getting too full. Amy Green with WMFE in Orlando is covering that story, and I talked with her earlier this morning. Amy, what's happening right now with Lake Okeechobee?
Well, water managers are watching Lake Okeechobee closely. They're worried that as stormwater runoff flows from here in central Florida, flows into the Kissimmee River and then into the state's largest lake, they're worried about Lake Okeechobee rising. They expect Lake Okeechobee could rise as high as 17 feet, which would be some of the highest levels the lake has seen in the past decade. The dike containing the lake is the subject of a restoration. It's an aging dike, and the condition is not that great. And so it's the subject of a restoration. And so there are concerns about the dike as the lake level rises too high, and we were told yesterday on a conference call with reporters that if the lake gets higher than 18 feet, at that point the dike is considered untested, and so water managers are watching that lake level closely at this point.
So they're always going to keep the water level lower than 18 feet. So how do they plan to do that?
They're going to start releasing as much water as practical at this point from the east side of the lake through the St. Lucie River, and they'll start releasing that water today. And they're going to release as much water as practical on the east side. They're going to wait, and they're not going to release water on the west side immediately, because on the west side, as you know, there in Fort Myers, the west side is at capacity in the wake of Hurricane Irma. But they will start releasing water on the west side as soon as that's practical.
As soon as the water levels here go down to a point where it's not going to add to the flooding issues?
Exactly.
So has anything happened since the last time we had Lake Okeechobee releases? I think it was a couple of years ago when we ended up with all the green slime and things that were associated with the nutrients in the water that was released from Lake Okeechobee that ended up causing those kinds of problems, or are we going to expect to see that again?
That was last year, and, you know, I haven't talked to anyone about that. I would be kind of surprised if we see that kind of harmful algae bloom again in the wake of Hurricane Irma, because a storm like Hurricane Irma has a flushing effect on estuaries. The nutrients that flow from Lake Okeechobee into the estuaries that feed those harmful algae blooms, that would be flushed by a storm by Hurricane Irma. We're also a little later in the year, and those harmful algae blooms need warm water. They need warm weather to really flourish. So I'm not a scientist. This is just my own opinion. I don't expect that to be a problem like it was last year.
Yeah, I know that people always want to keep an eye on that, and we live in fear of that happening again as well as in fear of hurricanes, right?
Right.
Well, thank you for the update. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Lee County schools closed their doors ahead of Hurricane Irma, but now, as WGCU's Quincy Walters reports, the damage from the storm means students won't return to school until near the end of the month.
At a press conference, Lee County School District Superintendent Gregory Atkins says the date to return to school will be Monday, September 25th.
The recovery process is taking quite longer than we thought it would. And we found that most of our buildings did sustain some damage.
He says most of the damage is minor, things like downed trees and water intrusion. However, Atkins says some schools' portable buildings were destroyed. Two high schools and one elementary school have roof damage so significant they may need to be replaced. The superintendent says contractors are at the ready to replace them. Atkins says 30 schools in the Lee County School District don't have power. He says the September 25th date also gives students and staff time to come back to the area.
Many of them evacuated this area and are having difficulty getting back.
There are closed roadways and gas shortages to contend with. Plus, a few of the schools are still being used as hurricane shelters. The superintendent says the Lee School District has to consult with the Department of Education about makeup dates since students are going to miss so much school.
We will definitely be looking at our schedule again and determine when we can make up days in the school year. We'll also be working with the Department of Education because they also may consider waiving some of those days.
But for all those kids listening, Superintendent Atkins has this message for you.
I would encourage students to read.
He says students and their parents should check their school's websites for updates, which may have some educational activities for students to work on. Quincy Walters, WGCU News.
Meanwhile, in Collier County, district officials announced today 26 of the district's 54 school sites have power, but students will not be returning to class until Monday, September 25th. Teachers are set to return to their classrooms a week from today by Friday, September 22nd. District officials say that the countywide boil water notice impacts school water fountains and food preparation, and it's leading to ongoing water pressure issues. They say sewage system issues are also causing backups in schools, and that's in addition to needing to clean nearly 30 schools that sheltered evacuees, housed pets, and had sewage issues during Hurricane Irma. Six of those schools are still serving as shelters as of today. Again, Collier County Schools saying the earliest classes could resume not resume until Monday, September 25th. Meanwhile, in Charlotte County, the public school system says they are close to ready to welcome students back to school on Monday. School officials say the Charlotte Harbor Center is the only site that does not have full power. Today, Charlotte County was running bus routes to make sure they were clear and there were no road hazards as maintenance teams continued clearing tree branches and other debris from school grounds. Meanwhile, the lack of power, extended closures of area restaurants, and limited supplies have many people facing an unusual dilemma of trying to find something to eat. Yesterday on the show, we talked about Mercy Chefs who have set up in the parking lot of the Living Waters Church at U.S. 41 and Williams Road in Estero. Now, a number of local chefs are volunteering their time, including Chef Brian Rowland and his team from Crave Culinaire. He joins us on the phone now. Brian, thanks for being part of the show.
My pleasure, Julia. I'm happy to be able to reach out and connect with you while we're in the middle of doing this.
So what's it like out there with Mercy Chefs in the parking lot right now?
You know, it's really, I can't express to you how great it is to be able to surround myself by so many gracious people who have come from all over Southwest Florida to help here. And Mercy Chefs is such a wonderful initiative. They are, you know, they get everything through donation. And they go disaster relief. They travel around and just pop up tents and get their propane gas to fuel their ovens, fuel their facility, and they get a big refrigerated truck dropped off, and then all their donations for food start coming in, and then they get their volunteers lined up. And so we've got a team of about 25 of us there from my team and family. And we are preparing lunch and dinner for roughly, I think, about 4,500 today.
Yeah, this is for some of these people. This is the first hot, good home-cooked meal that, well, not kind of home-cooked, but I guess trailer-cooked. But it's the first thing that they've had to eat that's warm and made with love like that for almost a week. How have people been responding so far?
It's amazing. I mean, a lot of the meals right now we're actually taking off-site, too, and we're delivering them to some of the communities that are in need. Social media has been such a huge help for us to get that outreach out there. And so, you know, we had a pastor that contacted us that said there were about 200 children around a church out in Immokalee that were really in need of food. As soon as I got on site today, I was able to connect with the head of food operations here, and we were able to get the truck loaded up, and food just went out to feed all of them. So, you know, but those that are coming here huge smiles on their faces. Everybody's extremely thankful. And there's no real limit to who we'll feed. It's really anyone that comes here to the location at Living Waters Church can grab a hot meal. And they can eat it here. There's some tables and chairs set up, or they can take it with them back home.
What's on the menu today?
Let's see. For lunch, we did some great roast chicken, some vegetables. We did a nice stuffing. And then we flipped over and went right into dinner service now, and we're just getting some Salisbury steak seared, and we've got mashed potatoes, some more vegetables and salad, and brownies for dessert that we're just getting out of the oven.
So I'll be right over. One might wonder, Chef, what would you cook if you didn't have power?
Gosh, I mean, honestly, my house and my business, we still don't have power. Thankfully, I'm able to stay with my brother right now in Fort Myers, but you know, for me, it's kind of a, you know, you go back to the day where there was no electricity, and what they did back then is, you know, they were pickling, preserving, they were sprouting things. And, you know, so if you can find ingredients that, like grains and lentils and beans, soak them overnight, and then it'll be, depending on what the grain is, within the first couple of days, you'll start to see them sprout, and they're actually living organisms. So they're healthy for you. They really get, you know, enzymes and proteins into your body, and can be very healthy and nutritious. And by doing this, you don't need to cook them, and they're much easier to digest. So that's a great way, I would say, if you can find things like grains and sprout them. But if you do have propane, even if you have a grill, you can put a pot of water on the grill and get it hot, and hopefully start to cook, you know, things like grains and quinoa and things like that, and rice. Things that have a much better shelf life once they're cooked, they'll last for a few days, are definitely a great suggestion. I know ice is still very scarce around here, and refrigeration obviously is as well, so it's a little difficult to take some of the fresh produce, but you know, if you can buy it in smaller amounts, if you're able to. I know a lot of Publix are opening up around here, and still be able to fuel your body with fresh ingredients, that's always you know, a great thing to do as well.
And that challenge when there's no refrigeration is getting that protein in there. So then you have the things like the nuts and like the legumes and beans, like you were mentioning earlier. And and now here's another question. Is there a canned bean that you would suggest that's a little bit easier for people to deal with?
You know, I think black beans, you know, red beans, I think are good too. Kidney beans. You know, they're easy. They go well with a lot of different ingredients as well, and they don't need much in terms of seasoning. You know, and if you're going the canned route, you can take things like canned corn and green beans and make a nice mix of a whole bunch of those. If you can get your hands on some type of a vinegar maybe or a little bit of olive oil and even just some simple seasoning, salt and pepper, you know, all that can be dry good items that don't need to have, you know, you don't need to have fresh herbs to make something taste good. But I think doing a good mix of things can help increase the flavor as well.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Brian. Thanks for taking a little time off the line to join us for the show today. I know you want to get back in there, so I'm going to let you get back
Absolutely.
At it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And just to let everyone know, dinner for tonight is from 5 o'clock to 7 p.m., and we're going to be right back at it tomorrow. Lunch is 11 to 1 each day. So we're going to keep on keeping on up here until it seems like everybody's back to normalcy.
All right. Thanks so much, Brian.
My pleasure, Julie. Thank you.
And now here in the studio, Chef Christina Sanfilippo is here from Purple Spoon. Last night, you swung open your doors for a free community meal. I stopped by, saw a bunch of firefighters and some locals. What made you want to do that?
Just a chance to bring everyone together and turn off the chaos for a little bit.
We kind of just celebrating we survived.
Yeah, pretty much. It's been a very stressful couple of days on all of us in many different areas, and to walk away from that for a few hours, sit down with people that are in the same situation, eat some good food that you didn't have to worry about preparing or cleaning up or any of that.
Or foraging for.
Exactly. Yes. Hunting down. It was one of the most wonderfully jovial and just calming nights I think I've had in my entire career. And it was a beautiful response from everybody. I had people meet new neighbors. I had people run into some of their neighbors they didn't know were back in town yet.
Yeah. So welcome back, right?
Exactly.
So what are some of the challenges that you've encountered when it comes to dealing with power and not having power? Did you lose power there?
We did lose power. I was at both my home and at the kitchen, and we were very lucky that we have amazing refrigerators and freezers that kept their suction the whole time and nothing changed temperature. So we were really lucky. We happened to have the fire station right down the street, so we got power back quickly. Yeah. And that was another reason to go ahead and open up, because all the food I had was still good. And let's go ahead and serve it up for those who had nowhere else to go. And we had to, of course, invite the firemen because – they had part to do with why we got power back so quickly.
Yeah, exactly. They were happy to be there. And then a lot of people don't have really awesome refrigerators and freezers. Right. And also they don't have very disciplined human beings in their house when the power goes out. A friend of mine was on Facebook saying that her husband lost refrigerator privileges because it was like he was searching for the meaning of life in there. When you have a refrigerator that goes down like that, what kind of things can you absolutely not keep?
If anything in the refrigerator goes over 40 degrees is where you get concerned, especially if it's high protein, animal proteins. Those are the first that you are going to have to let go. Produce that is going to hold its integrity, like apples, bananas, cabbages, onions, those things don't go bad very quickly.
We're talking like cheeses and milks have to go.
Yeah, cheeses and milk. Well, cheeses that are aged actually hold really well.
They might be okay.
They do well at 55 degrees.
Oh, 55 degrees.
But milks, absolutely. Those need to go. And any animal proteins.
Meats.
Right.
Meats. And even lunch meats and the processed stuff? I know you're not a fan of those anyway in general, but I mean
– to be safe, it's better to let it go. They do have preservatives in them. So if it still feels like it's 40, 45 degrees, they're fine. Not a huge concern.
Okay. And then we need to look at the door, the condiment section. Everything says that you need to keep it refrigerated.
Right.
Do you really have to keep ketchup refrigerated?
No, you don't. Ketchup, fish sauce, mustards, jellies, jams, they are all – preserves. They have been for hundreds.
So they're going to be okay.
They're fine.
But the mayo's got to go?
The mayonnaise probably needs to go. But to be honest, it's actually not one of the highest risk because it's mostly oil.
Oh.
So oils are pretty stable.
Well, let's talk about the other component then, eggs.
Yes.
So eggs, in other countries, they don't even refrigerate them at all.
Personally, I would say eggs are one of your best proteins to eat right now. For health code regulations, I'm not supposed to say that. So ignore that part. But for being rational right now, what's going on? One, if you can find a neighbor or somewhere in like in Bonita, we have Circle C. We have our farmers coming down on Wednesday with fresh eggs. Those are some of the best protein sources you could get. And they're completely safe because the hens just laid them. They've been stored appropriately because all these places do have electricity now. And they're one of the easiest things for us to digest. So especially in a time of need, you got to think about what your body can handle and also replenishing. We've all been on a bit of an adrenaline rush and a little heavy loads.
Yeah, so. And peanut butter and cheese cracker diet.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I know. I'm sure. I'm just naming off your favorites. So let's take a look at the freezer. I mean, obviously your ice is gone. But when things have defrosted, at what point do you consider it? Even if your steak defrosts maybe a centimeter in, can you refreeze that thing or do you need to throw it or grill it?
At home, you can refreeze it. In the restaurant business, we can't.
Okay.
If you cook it to the appropriate temperature, that's the safest thing to do. I would actually say that anything meat-wise in your freezer that you have questions about, take it out, put it into some kind of pot, add some acidity, some liquid, and braise it when you get power back on. So if you can keep it cold until you have power, braising is when you cook it for a long time, low temperature with acidity. It's going to kill off anything that would be questionable. It's actually going to tenderize the meat and make it very easy to digest and taste delicious.
Okay. And then the frozen vegetables, do you have to worry about those guys?
Not as much. You're going to cook them. You're going to bring them up to temperature. There's not that much in frozen vegetables that can actually go bad. And you'll know if they're bad. They will go slimy really fast.
Oh, yeah. That is just not a good experience.
And don't feed them to your pets.
Yeah, don't
please
take your stuff and think that it's not good enough for me, but it's good enough for Fido.
Right.
Because it can make them sick too.
It is. It's going to make them sick. They've been under stress just like we have.
And then as far as dry goods, are there any things that are sitting on the shelves that are not in the refrigerator that because of having no air conditioning and all that humidity that are going to be affected by this?
Affected in a negative way, not so much. They're actually – this is a great time to start on a plant-based diet. this is probably what I've been living off of for the past couple of days is seeds, nuts, granola. Very good. My indulgence, dark chocolate. Dark chocolate is stable at room temperature as long as it doesn't get so hot it starts to melt. But dark chocolate melts at a pretty high temperature, to be honest.
And well, I know it melts at 98.6, which is in my hand.
Well, there you go. Actually, 92. But yes, close.
At least 98. I'm not going to say so. What if you have rice or oats or something like that? Are they going to be damaged by being in humidity like that?
If they were sealed in a plastic container, no. They should be fine. If they were... they got wet for any reason, or if anything looks like it has moisture built up inside of the bag, then you would be concerned and go ahead and let it go. But most seeds and nuts can hold at room temperature. Oats hold at room temperature very well.
So the deadline that FP&L set for itself is September 22nd before power is restored to everyone in Florida, and that's a week away.
It is.
But now grocery stores are starting to open. So some people can go out and get things. What kind of things would you suggest for people to buy if they're able to get to the store but they still have no power?
Right. All right. So the items to pick up are the things that you can eat easily, either in the package they come in or take minimal work in the kitchen, because we're all on restrictions for wastewater. You don't want to be dealing with a bunch of dishes. Brian mentioned something great about cooking your grains on the grill. It's brilliant. You put quinoa, you put millet and water, put it on the grill, cook it through, make a big batch.
And then maybe the pre-washed vegetables would be a good idea, so you're not using all that water.
Right, exactly. That would definitely help. But also getting something like bananas, oranges, apples. Those are completely stable at room temperature. They're great nutrition. They have good vitamin C. And they come in their own package. Apples, you just have to do a quick wash on the outside. Right. But definitely nuts, seeds, those are awesome for you right now. Dried fruit. Dried fruits are sweet. They're going to hit that kind of, I need something sweet to munch on. But they have great density of antioxidants, and it's good calories. You're going to burn them efficiently.
Yeah, and with all this stress, you want to keep those antioxidants going so you don't end up getting sick, right?
Which is why dark chocolate's so good.
Well, I'm going to have some of that in a minute. So thank you, Chef Christina Sanfilippo with Purple Spoon. And we also wanted to remind people of reports of carbon monoxide poisoning are coming in. There have been 74 cases of CO poisoning in the last 2 days because of people using their generators in a place that's not safe. So make sure to have that outside. And be aware of the symptoms. You can get headache, dizziness, weakness, nausea, vomiting, chest pain, and confusion. Those are the symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning. So be aware of that. And if you feel that you're experiencing that, be sure to call 911. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.1. 1.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.